Hello, my name is Stephanie Straw, and I'd like to welcome you to part two of our Practice Guides podcast with Rebecca Milner, a solicitor and assistant land registrar at HM Land Registry, and Callum Leary, a senior associate in the Commercial Real Estate Department at law firm Mo Barlow. In part one, we discussed the benefits of using practice guides, along with specific topics to help you when submitting applications to HM Land Registry. We also shared some top tips for getting the most out of practice guides. In part two, Rebecca answers Callum's questions, addressing topics such as electronic signatures, the introduction of new digital ID requirements, and overseas entities. Before we listen to part two, just a top tip, you can keep up with changes to practice guides by signing up for alerts through gov.uk or subscribe to our monthly newsletter, Practice and Process, which details all the recent updates. You'll find more information in the podcast transcript. Over to you, Callum and Rebecca.
I've very much used this as my chance to gain as much information as I can on things I was unsure on. So I've prepared quite a few questions and things on things that we were talking about. So one of the big things that has obviously changed over the last few years is the rise of electronic signatures and DocuSign and Legal eSign and other such softwares that allow you to do that. And there is a very helpful, obviously, Practice Guide 82 for electronic signatures. One of the things that we have come across, which we were unsure of the answer and would have looked through the practice guide for, is where a document has been executed in DocuSign or Legal eSign by a client and they have signed, their signature has been witnessed, and the envelope is closed, and you get that document and it's there signed, but there's no dates, there's no manuscripts dating or blank spaces, etc. filled in. Would the Land Registry accept that document if it is a deed, if at the point of completion, the conveyancer prints off that document and inserts those dates and blank spaces in manuscript?
A great topic and a great practice guide to raise, given how it came into fruition slightly quicker than it would have due to the global pandemic in 2020. An interesting question and one that we've been discussing internally at Land Registry, and our requirements for accepting for registration a document that's been signed with an electronic signature were established after consultation with customers and the signature providers that you mentioned, Callum. And we tried to balance the capability of developing e-signature services, the needs of our customers, and the assurance that we require as HMLR from the signature process to ensure the integrity of the register. Signposting paragraph 3.2 of Practice Guide 82, for those of you who want to know, this includes the numbered steps that will ensure that we can accept that electronically signed document for registration purposes. So if the date of a document has been added outside of the signature platform, as Callum mentioned, after electronic signing, the requirements set out in paragraph 3.2, step 6, have not strictly been complied with, and a conveyancer wouldn't be able to give that required certificate. We may, in some situations, still accept the document for registration, but it's likely that we'd ask for additional evidence about the signature process. This should, though, and it's important to stress, be an exception to the rule to assist when genuine mistakes have happened, rather than it being normal day-to-day practice of conveyances. You know, it may be possible to deal with an addition of a date and completion of other blank fields as amendments to the signed document. And paragraph 3.3 of Practice Guide 82 sets out what our current practice is for accepting amendments to dispositionary deeds when the amendment is identified before the application for registration is lodged with us. And I think that, from our perspective, it is key. Yeah. It becomes much more difficult for us to regularise the position if it is after we've registered the transaction. And this involves collating two copies of completed deed. One copy is a final version produced within the platform, and the second copy includes the required manuscript amendments and an endorsement about when and how the electronic deed has been amended. I hope that answers your question to an extent.
It does, yeah. It's very interesting. They're all very technical points, aren't they? But it's very it is interesting to know, because yes, the thing that is most likely, I would imagine, to happen in that scenario is that one of the text boxes has been missed in the DocuSign point. So I certainly have been and have used the endorsement procedure previously, and obviously we are required as conveyancers to give the PG82, as it's now commonly known, as certificate for to confirm that all the requirements have been met. So that's extremely useful, and will definitely be one that that we consider going forward. And I believe we have had one recently where we have had that. So I may need to go back and have a little look at that one. So
we also at Callum have an electronic signatures webinar that was released about a month ago. You can find this on gov.uk, our HMN registry gov.uk website training hub. So it covers Mercury signing, conveyance certified electronic signatures, using mixed methods for signing documents, and we touch upon like the future of electronic signatures in land registration as well, which you might find useful.
I'll be sure to put it on as soon as I get home.
You said you had a few questions.
Yeah, Callum. I'm lining them up. How long have we got?
Line them up.
Okay, so the other new, I suppose, practice guide or element is the overseas entities. So looking at practice guide 78 here, really, and the introduction of the new requirements for them to be registered at Companies House, etc. It's a big change in commercial property, or not just commercial property, sorry, I'm referencing commercial property being that my area, but it's a big thing that has changed over the last couple of years in that. So whilst many of the requirements are fairly clear, one of the interesting ones I potentially didn't know the answer to was if an overseas entity is a party to a deed but is not, in my head I'm particularly thinking of a lease, for example, where say you've got the landlord and the tenant and a management company, say, and if the management company is an overseas entity, so registered in a foreign jurisdiction, but the landlord and the tenant are not. They're both companies incorporated in England or Wales. Does that management company have to have an overseas entity ID registered from Companies House, or is it only the party that either is or is going to be the registered proprietor of the property?
In short, no, they don't. It's only going to be the party that is the proprietor. There are other exceptions to this that you can find at paragraph 3.2 and 4.2 of Schedule 4.8, the Land Registration Act 2002. Have you come across any recently in Callum, any others?
So the only one that we have come across recently where we thought it might apply, but then having looked into it further, it didn't, was the fact that the overseas entity had been the registered proprietor of the property for quite some time, and therefore prior to the 1st of Jan 1999. So therefore it didn't apply to that particular entity, which again was another little change that we weren't aware of at the time.
Yeah, a very important exception to highlight. From my perspective, a lot of the other inquiries that we've had since the introduction of this legislation is around restrictions on title. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've also encountered, Callum?
Yes, the restriction is one that sort of either panics new tenants or somewhat if they're not fully aware of what it means or what it's doing. I mean, the main thing I think from my perspective in respect of that was whether an overseas entity has that ID number from Companies House, do any restrictions on the title automatically get removed, or is either a separate application needed to do that, or is the only scenario where it can be removed at the point of a future disposition?
Well, essentially, the legislation that's applicable obliges the registrar to enter the restriction and then consider it again on a future disposition, but there's no provision for its removal if the overseas entity ID number is provided earlier than that. The restriction would only be automatically removed on registration of a new registered proprietor as a registered estate, and this includes a disposition to a new overseas entity, in which case a new row restriction would be entered when the new proprietor goes on the register.
So a disposition is the only formal way currently.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm sort of going to loop back towards the digital aspect. Obviously, we covered digital signatures and the other fairly newish digital practice guide or requirements that have come out of the ID requirements, which are something that certainly we as a firm over the last couple of years and certainly during the pandemic have really looked at and focused on, is about the identity of our clients and how we can manage that on an electronic basis as meeting in person, etc., was obviously impossible at certain points, and now it's sort of slightly more tricky in that people are working from home more, so not necessarily around offices quite as much anymore. So I was interested to look at sort of Practice Guide 81 and the new requirements about sort of the Land Registry's digital ID requirements and what the benefit of meeting that is for conveyancers.
This is a really good one to raise and one that I'm particularly interested in, partly from my background as a property litigator. As Callum mentioned, HMLR, like all fundamental parts of the economy and the conveyancing sector, had to adapt its policy and procedures in response to the global pandemic. And there were challenges posed to conveyancing professionals to verify identity of clients when, you know, meeting in person was not possible or impossible at times due to the laws in place. And therefore, we went away and prepared Practice Guide 81 that was published originally in March 2021 that sets out a digital identity standard. And it is almost a checklist of what we would expect to see from a Land Registry perspective in relation to the checks made by a conveyancing professional to verify the identity of their client. And, you know, this involves biometric and cryptographic checking of identity and verification that individual or individuals signing behalf of corporations are actually the owner of the property or otherwise, most importantly, a genuine party to a registrable transaction. Property fraud does exist. And it's certainly something that I've come across fairly regularly in my legal career, being from a litigation perspective and a litigation background. And it's important that conveyancers are aware that when this standard that's set out in Practice Guide 81 is followed, HM Land Registry considers this a discharge of the conveyancer's duty to verify the identity of a party to a registrable transaction. And I think one term that is important to flag that forms part of Practice Guide 81 is the safe harbour. Mm. So a conveyancer who adopts the identity standard approach will have fulfilled their obligation to take reasonable steps in relation to the requirement to verify their client's identity. And at this point, they'll reach a safe harbour from a Land Registry perspective. This is the point where my litigation background and litigation spirit comes in, because it links into Schedule 8 of the Land Registration Act, which covers indemnity. Those of you who are listening may have come across Practice Guide 39, which covers rectification and indemnity in relation to the register. And generally speaking, Schedule 8 provides in situations where a mistake is on the register, which leads to a loss being suffered. For example, as you know, the easiest to identify example is where there's been a fraudulent transaction, either a fraudulent mortgage or a fraudulent transfer of property. We as HMLR have a state guarantee under Schedule 8 and a duty to make an indemnity or a compensation repayment to the person suffering that loss. Once we've made that payment, paragraph 10 of Schedule 8 of the 2002 Act enables us to consider pursuing rights of recourse, and that would be where we could step into the shoes of the wronged party or the claimant for indemnity and acquire any cause of action that they may have had we not paid out the indemnity. The most obvious circumstance would be if their solicitor has been negligent in relation to the fraudulent transaction, we would step into the shoes of the indemnity claimant and pursue a claim for professional negligence against that solicitor to try and recover some of the public money that we've paid out under the state guarantee. Linking back to the safe harbour, if for example, in a fraudulent transaction where someone trying to impersonate the actual registered proprietor of a property and the solicitor has followed the digital identity checklist, we would consider them reaching a safe harbour, which would mean that we would unlikely pursue them to recover an indemnity that we would pay out. So that also links into the firm's professional indemnity. One that I've been heavily involved in and I'm fascinated by as a litigator and something important to flag, because certainly I don't think all conveyancers in private practices are aware that Land Registry has an ability to recover any indemnity payments that have made under the state guarantee from a negligent solicitor in certain circumstances. So one to remember when you go back to
absolutely
work, Alan.
Very much highlights the importance of firms doing not only for, obviously there are requirements for anti-money laundering checks, etc. Mm. So not only that, but for from a conveyancing property perspective for this as well. Very, very important.
And it reflects Land Registry's commitment to work closely with firms on future initiatives such as this and training, and so that we have a partnership. And there's Safe Harbour as an example of, here is what we think is an acceptable identity standard, and if you follow that, then, you know, in return, we won't pursue you for any claim under Schedule 8 in future.
Absolutely, and it's great that it's evolved into the electronic use of the verifying identity as well, as opposed to just being that in physical person, because obviously that's how the world has changed and where we're living now, and extremely mm-hmm. useful.
So that brings us to the end of the podcast. I'd just like to say thank you to Rebecca and Callum for joining me, and to you for listening. Please follow HM Land Registry on SoundCloud to get notified of any new and upcoming podcasts. Thanks again, and hope you can join us again soon.